She took the hand and allowed him to pull her to her feet. I'd know if I had a passport. Mine expired 2 years ago.
I got you another one.
He still hadn't dropped her hand. She still hadn't pulled it away.
Where'd you get a picture?
The photo booth in the mall that time.
Not bad, she thought. Not bad. She pulled the key out of her pocket. She held it up and watched him come back from the dead for the second time in 15 minutes. This key? He blinked several times, then nodded. She put it back in her pocket. Why did Caleb have it?
Caleb was supposed to get the passports. He and I could impersonate each other in our sleep. Shit, his version of my signature looked more like mine than mine.
He looked up at the hard sky.
You and I were supposed to slip into Canada, meet the others in a place called Saint-Prosper. From there, we'd all go to Quebec City, fly out of the country.
She looked in his eyes, and he looked back, and neither of them said a word, until she said, So all six of us were supposed to leave the country together?
That was the plan, yeah.
You, your best friend, his wife and child, and your two wives. He dropped her hand.
Nicole wasn't my wife.
Then who was she?
My sister.
She stepped back and took a hard look at his face to see if he was telling the truth or not. But then what did she know about that? She'd lived with him for 3 years and never knew his real name or profession or history. Just 2 nights ago, he'd convinced her he was dead, stared back at her with sightless eyes from the bottom of the ocean. This was not a man who wore his lies the way normal people wore theirs.
Was your sister pregnant?
He nodded. Who was the father?
We don't have time for this.
Who was the father?
Guy named Joel, okay? Worked at the bank with her. Married guy, 3 kids of his own. It was a fling. But Nicole always wanted a kid, so even after she broke things off with Joel, she went forward with the pregnancy. She didn't need Joel's support. We were going to be sitting on 70 million. You want to meet Joel? I can set it up. You can ask him if his dead ex-mistress was 6 months pregnant with his child when someone executed her in her kitchen because her brother...
He was pacing now, agitated.
Her dumb fuck brother left his car in front of her house while he went back to Boston to shock you back to reality.
Her laugh sounded like a bark.
You what? You tried to shock me back to reality?
He was all earnest innocence.
Well, yeah.
That's the biggest load of horseshit I've ever heard.
I needed you ready to run. I didn't expect Cotter McCann to bite down hard on the hook for, shit, 3 months. 6? I was hoping for 6. But they fucking bit early because they're aggressive and greedy and they want what they want on their timetable, no one else's. I didn't expect them to put the money into our account and hire an independent consulting firm to double-check the mine on the same day. But they did. And I didn't expect them to put a 2-man hit squad on me and my crew simultaneously. But once again, they did. So I had to skip Plan A, dump Plan B, and go right to Plan C, the one where I shock you the fuck awake. And what do you know, it worked.
Nothing worked. Nothing.
You afraid to drive anymore?
No.
Afraid to take cabs?
No.
Afraid of wilderness or wide open spaces? How about elevators? Diving into the ocean? Have you had a panic attack, Rachel, since this whole thing started?
How could I tell? I've been in a state of panic ever since I saw you walk out of the back of a building in Boston when you said you were in London.
Right. He nodded. And you've overcome that panic every minute of every day since, to do what needed to be done. Including killing me, by the way.
But you didn't die.
Yeah, well, my apologies.
He put his hands on her shoulders.
You're not afraid anymore, because you stopped listening to anyone but your own primal self. You had all the evidence you needed to crawl back into your life and stay there. I didn't paint the clues in neon. I made you work for them. You could have trusted your eyes. The visa stamps looked real enough to give you just one example, but you trusted your instinct, babe. You acted from what you knew there.
He pointed at her chest.
Not here.
He pointed at her head. She stared at him for a long time.
Don't call me babe.
Why not?
Because I hate you.
He took that into consideration, shrugged.
That's how we usually feel about the things that wake us up.
Chapter 31 Safe House. They left Caleb's smashed-up SUV in the woods and drove the Range Rover 300 miles south to Woonsocket, Rhode Island, just south of the Massachusetts border and about 15 miles north of Providence. They'd had a lot of time to talk on the drive, but hadn't really, except about the essentials. They'd listened to the radio long enough to hear they were both considered persons of interest in the deaths of two people in two different states. Police in Providence and Boston were tight-lipped as to why they believed the murder of a small-town bank employee in Providence was connected to the murder of a businessman in Boston, but they were determined to meet with Brian Alden, the brother of the Providence victim and business partner of the Boston victim, and with Brian Alden's wife, Rachel Childs Delacroix. Handguns registered to both persons of interest had not been recovered at their Back Bay home, so they were to be considered armed. "Basically, my life is ruined," Rachel said somewhere near Lewiston, Maine. "Even if I could clear my name."
"Big if,"
Brian said. "I'd fuck myself financially to do it.
Spend a lot of time in jail while that was happening."
She shot him a dirty look he didn't see because his eyes were on the road. "And they could still bury me deep on ancillary charges." He nodded.
"Obstruction of justice comes to mind. Cops tend to get a bit miffed when you forget to tell them there's a corpse sitting at your dining room table. Leaving the scene of a crime, unlawful flight, reckless driving, I'm sure I'll think of a few more."
"This isn't funny," she said. He looked over at her.
"When did I give the impression it was?"
"Right now. You're being sarcastic, snarky."
"I get that way when I'm terrified."
"You're terrified? You?" He raised his eyebrows.
"Beyond terrified. If no one's found the safe house, and we can do what we need to do there, and if we can slip into Providence without being made, and if we can get into the bank and get to the safe deposit box where I stashed the passports and the running money, if we can still get back out of that bank and out of Providence and grab Haya and the baby and find an airport where no one's looking for us and our faces aren't plastered over everyone's home screen and the 9 TVs tuned to CNN in the airport bar, and if they don't have someone waiting for us in Amsterdam, then yes, we could possibly survive the year. But I'd put our odds at successfully navigating all those obstacles at, oh, I don't know, grim to none."
"Amsterdam," she said. "I thought the bank was in the Caymans."
"It is, but they'll definitely be waiting for us there. If we get to Amsterdam, we can wire it all to Switzerland."
"But why stop in Amsterdam?" He shrugged.
"I've always liked Amsterdam. You'd like it too. The old canals are pretty. A lot of bikes, though."
"You talk like you're taking me sightseeing."
"Well, that's the plan, isn't it?"
"We're not together," she said.
"No?"
"No, you lying sack of shit. This is a business arrangement from here on out." He rolled down his window for a moment, took a blast on his face to wake himself up, rolled the window back up.
"Okay,"
he said.
"You play the business tip, but I'm in love with you."
"You don't know the first thing about love."
"Guess we'll have to agree to disagree on that one."
"Did you ever search for my father?"
"What?"
"When I met you, you were a private investigator."
"That was a scam. My first one, actually."
"So you were never an actual private investigator?"
He shook his head. "I set up that front to do background checks for all the employees of a tech startup that was setting up shop in the area."
"Why would you set up a front just to do background checks?"
"There were 64 employees of that company, if memory serves. 64 DOBs, 64 SSNs, 64 histories."
"You stole 64 identities." He nodded. It was a quick nod, but full of pride.
"One of them's on your passport."
"But when I came through your office door?"
"I tried to talk you out of hiring me."
"But when I came back a few months later, you just took my money and..."
"I looked for your father, Rachel. I busted my ass on it. I wish I'd been smart enough to consider that James was his last name, but I wasn't. But I ID'd every professor with the first name James who'd taught in that region over the previous 20 years, just like I said I did.
The only honest work I ever did as a private eye, I did for you.
Why?
Because you're good.
I'm what?
You're good. You're one of the only good people I've ever met, and you're worth fighting for and fighting with. You're worth everything.
You're such a liar. You're running a fucking con right now, on me.
He thought about that. Eventually, he said, When I met you in the bar that night, Caleb and Nicole kept telling me to get rid of you. Grifters can't have love lives, they said, just sex lives. This from my sister who would end up getting knocked up by a married guy. She's giving me advice on love. And Caleb, who would marry a woman who couldn't speak English, those are my dear Abbeys.
He shook his head.
Don't fall in love. Well, that worked out fucking great for all of us.
She willed herself not to look over at him, but instead out the window.
I fell for you because that's what you do when you meet the woman whose face you want to be looking into when you die. You fall, and keep falling. And if you're really lucky, she falls with you and you never get back up again to where you were because if that was so great, you wouldn't have needed to fall in the first place. But when I fell all the way. I had just started this con. I met you the night I closed papers on the mine. Caleb was supposed to meet me at the bar to celebrate, but I saw you, and I texted him and told him I'd eaten bad tuna at lunch, and he went out to dinner somewhere by himself. And I looked across the bar, and I thought, that's Rachel Childs. I tried to find her father once. I used to watch her on the news. I used to wonder who was lucky enough to go home to you. And then that drunk fucked with you, and I got to come to your rescue. And the irony is, you thought it might be a con. I always loved that. Made me believe in God for a minute. And you left, and I ran out onto the streets looking for you.
He looked across at her.
I found you. And then we had the walk, and the blackout, and found our amazing bar.
What was playing when we entered?
Tom Waits.
What song?
Long Way Home.
Should have been 16 shells from a 30-06.
Be nice.
He shifted in his seat, resettled his wrist against the top of the wheel.
You might not like my methods, Rachel, and it may be unwelcome news to learn I make my living running long cons, so you can fall out of love with me, but I can't fall out of love with you. I wouldn't know how.
She almost bought it, if only for a second. But then she remembered who this man was, an actor, a con man, a grifter, a professional liar. People who love each other, she said, don't wreck each other's lives. He chuckled softly.
Sure they do. That's what love is. Where once there was one, now there's two. And that's so much less convenient and less orderly and less safe. You want me to apologize for blowing your life up? Okay, I'm sorry. But what did I blow up? Your mother's dead, you never knew your father, your friends are transitory at best, and you never leave the apartment. What life did I take, Rachel?
What life, indeed, she wondered, as they entered Woonsocket at sundown. It was a faded, cauterized mill town with hopeful pockets of gentrification that couldn't compensate for the air of abandonment. The main street was peppered with vacant storefronts. Some mills rose up behind those buildings, their windows broken or non-existent, the brick edifices festooned with graffiti, the land reclaiming the lower floors and punching cracks through the foundations. It had happened before she was born, this wholesale discarding of American industry, this switch from a culture that made things of value to a culture that consumed things of dubious merit. She'd grown up in the absence, in other people's memory of a dream so fragile it had probably been doomed from the moment of conception. If there had ever been a social contract between the country and its citizens, it was long gone now, save the Hobbesian agreement that had been in play since our ancestors had first stumbled from caves in search of food. Once I get mine, you're on your own. Brian drove over a series of dark, hilly streets and then down to a quartet of long, four-story buildings that comprised a failed mill sitting along the river with nothing else around it for blocks. Each brick building had at least 100 windows fronting the street and the same amount again on the riverside. The high window frames in the center of the buildings were twice as large as the others.
Brian drove around the complex to reveal a pair of covered passageways between the fourth floors connecting the buildings, so that the complex, if seen from the air, would look like a double H. "This is your safe house?" she said.
"No, this is an abandoned mill."
"So where's the safe house?"
"Nearby."
They rolled past broken windows and weeds the height of the Range Rover. Gravel and rocks and pebbles of broken glass crunched under his tires. He took out his phone and fired off a text to someone. A few seconds later, it vibrated with the return text. He put the phone back in his jacket. He drove around the mill twice more. At the tip of the property, he killed the headlights and rolled up a small knoll, just upriver from a dam by the sounds of it. At the top of the knoll, partially obscured by a stand of half-dead trees, stood a small brick two-story house with a black mansard roof. He put the Rover in park, but left the engine running, and they sat and watched the house.
"Used to be the night watchman's. Cities owned all this land ever since the mill went tits up in the 70s. Most of the land is probably poisoned, and no one has the money to test it, so they sold us this house for pennies on the dollar."
He shifted in his seat.
"It's got good bones, actually, and clear sight lines. Impossible to approach without being seen."
"Who'd you text?" she asked.
"Haya."
He nodded at the house.
"She's inside with Annabelle. Wanted her to know I was coming."
"So why aren't we going in?"
"We will."
"What are we waiting for?"
"For my sense of terror to be overridden by my impatience."
He looked up at the house. A light came from somewhere deep in the back of it.
"If all was clear, Haya was supposed to text, 'I am okay, come in.'"
"And?"
"She only texted the first half."
"Well, it's not her native tongue, and she's scared." He chewed on the inside of his mouth for a moment.
"We can't tell her about Caleb."
"We have to.
If she thinks he's just held up and will meet us in Amsterdam in a couple days, she'll keep her shit together. But if she doesn't..."
He turned in the seat, touched her hand. She pulled it back.
"We can't tell her." "Rachel, Rachel."
"What?"
"If this goes south, they will kill us all. The baby, too."
She stared through the dark Range Rover at him.
"We can't give her any reason to be any more unpredictable than she's liable to be already. We tell her in Amsterdam."
She nodded.
"I need to hear you say it.
We tell her in Amsterdam." Brian looked at her for a long time before he said,
"You still got your gun?"
"Yep." He reached under the seat and came back with a 9mm Glock, put it behind his back. "You've had a gun this whole time," she said.
"Shit, Rachel,"
he said with a distracted sigh.
"I've got three."
They walked around the outside of the house twice in the dark before Brian led them up the sagging back steps to a door that had lost most of its paint over the years. The floorboards squeaked underfoot, and the house itself creaked in an unseasonably cool wind, more early autumn than early summer. He moved along the porch, checked all the windows and the front door before they returned to the back. He unlocked the door, and they entered. An alarm beeped to their left, and Brian punched in her birth date on the keypad, and the beeping stopped. The central hallway ran straight from the back door, past an oak staircase to the front door. The house smelled clean but dusty, maybe a light foundational odor of mildew that 1,000 house cleanings could probably never remove. He produced 2 penlights from his jacket, handed her one, and turned on his own. Haya sat below the mail slot in the front door, junk mail off to her right, a gun clasped in her hands. Brian gave her a wave and a warm smile and came down the hall to her. She lowered her gun, and he hugged her awkwardly, and then they stood in front of her.
"Baby is asleep,"
she pointed at the ceiling.
"You need sleep,"
Brian said.
"You look exhausted."
"Where is Caleb?"
"The bad men, Haya. They may be following him. He didn't want to lead them here, to you and Annabelle. You understand?"
Her breath was coming too fast. She bit her upper lip so hard Rachel feared it would spout blood.
"He is alive?"
"Jesus." "He is,
Brian said. He's going to go out through Maine. Remember how we talked about it? He's going to cross into Canada and fly out of Toronto. No one will be able to track him in Maine. We know that terrain. You understand terrain? She nodded twice.
He will be okay?
He will be, Brian said with a firmness Rachel despised.
He does not answer his mobile phone.
We explained that. They can track a phone, Haya. If any of us thinks they're being followed, they stay off the phone. Brian took her hands in his. It's going to be okay. We'll all be out of here in the morning. Haya looked at Rachel, woman to woman, a look that transcended any language barrier. Can I trust this man? Rachel blinked an affirmative. Get some sleep. You'll need the rest. Haya climbed the dark stairs, and Rachel resisted the urge to run to her and tell her everything they'd said was a lie. Her husband was dead. The father of her child was dead. She and her infant were about to go on the run with a pair of two-faced strangers who lied to her and would continue to lie to her until she couldn't fuck up their escape. Haya turned right at the top of the stairs, and Rachel lost sight of her. Brian read her mind. What do you want to tell her?
That her husband is dead,
she whispered. Fine, be my guest. He waved his arm at the staircase with a flourish.
Don't be cruel, she said after a moment.
Don't be judgmental, he said, unless you're willing to walk the walk. They checked the downstairs together, room by room, and it was empty. Only then did he turn on the lights. Sure that's wise? She asked.
If they knew about the place, he said, they'd have been out in the mill or inside with her. They aren't, which means this safe house is still safe. Nicole didn't give it up, probably because they didn't know to ask her. Haya's got the bedroom up top on the right.
His body sagged with exhaustion all at once, and she realized how wiped she was as well. He used his gun hand to point vaguely back up the stairs.
There's a linen closet outside the bathroom. The first bedroom on the left has a dresser with a bunch of clothes in your size. Let's each take a shower, I'll put on some coffee, and we'll get back to work.
What do we have to work at?
I gotta teach you a little forgery.
Chapter 32 Confession. Hair still wet, coffee in a mug, wearing a t-shirt, hoodie, and sweats that were, as promised, in her size, she sat at the table with her husband. Was he still that? As he placed a pad of blank paper in front of her with a pen, he then laid down several documents with his sister's signature on them. I'm going to be Nicole.
For the 5 minutes it should take to get in and out of that bank, you're going to be Nicole's last alias.
He dug around in a gym bag until he came back with a small stack of IDs and credit cards wrapped in a rubber band. He extracted a Rhode Island driver's license. It was in the name of Nicole Rosevich. As he placed it on the table in front of her, Brian shook his head tightly. She got the feeling he didn't know he was doing it. I don't look anything like her, she said.
Similar bone structure, he argued.
Eyes are different.
That's why I keep a set of color contacts.
They're shaped differently, she pointed, and hers were bigger, her lips are thinner.
But your nose is close and so's your chin.
Anyone will be able to tell I'm not her.
A straight, almost middle-aged guy with the 2.2 kids, the world's most boring job, and I'll assume the corresponding world's most boring wife? He's gonna remember one thing about the hot blonde in his office 3 months ago, that she was a hot blonde. So let's make you a blonde. The hot part's already covered.
She ignored the appeal to her vanity. You've got the right hair dye in this place?
I got wigs. Same ones she wore.
Banks have face recognition software these days, you know.
Not at this bank, he said. That's why I picked it. When in doubt, go mom and pop. This bank has been in Johnston for 3 generations. They only got an ATM 4 years ago, and only after their customers filed a petition. The owner, that's who you'll be meeting, is also the bank manager and handles all safe deposit transactions. His name is Manfred Thorpe.
Get the fuck out of here, she said. He straddled the chair beside her.
No, really. He told me the name Manfred goes back in the family 1,000 years. Says every generation has to name one kid Manfred, and he, as he put it, drew the short straw.
How well do you know him?
Just met him once.
But you know all that about him?
He shrugged. People like talking to me. My father was the same.
Who was your father? She turned her chair toward him. Your real father.
Jamie Alden, he said brightly. People called him Lefty.
Because he was left-handed? He shook his head.
Because he never met a place or a person he wouldn't leave. Left the army without telling them, left about 20 jobs, left 3 wives before my mother and 2 more after her. He'd pop back in and out of my life until he stuck up the wrong jeweler in Philadelphia. Guy was armed to the teeth, and Lefty wasn't a shooter anyway. Guy killed my dad.
He shrugged.
Live by the sword, die by the sword, I guess.
When did this happen? He looked up at the ceiling as he searched his memory.
While I was at Trinity.
When you got kicked out? He acknowledged her scoop of that little fact with a head cock and a small smile, stayed that way for a moment, staring across the table, and eventually nodded.
Day after I found out he was dead, yeah, I kicked the shit out of Professor Nigel Rawlins.
With a plunger.
It was on hand.
He chuckled suddenly at the memory. What?
That, he said, was a good day.
She shook her head at him. You got thrown out of acting school for assault. He nodded.
And battery.
How's that a good day?
I acted on my instinct. I knew what he was doing to Caleb was wrong, and I knew what I had to do was right. Nigel kept his job. Might still be teaching second-rate method acting tips to students right now, for all I know. But I bet my share of the $70 million he'll never treat another student like he treated Caleb, or the victims who came before Caleb. Because he's got it in the back of his head that one of the other students in his class might go all psycho Brian Alden on him and face-fuck him with a plunger. What I did that day was exactly what I needed to do.
And me? She said after a bit.
What about you?
I don't act on my instincts. I don't engage the world.
Sure you do. You just fell out of practice. But now you're back, babe.
Don't call me babe.
Okay.
You've been running this mining scam for, what, 4 years? He thought about it, did some math in his head.
About that, yeah.
But how long have you pretended to be Brian Delacroix? Something akin to shame found his face.
On and off for almost 20 years.
Why? He was quiet for a long time, turning the question over as if no one had ever thought to ask him before.
Back in Providence, I was at work one night at the pizza place when a co-worker said, "Your double's in the bar across the street." So I went over, and sure enough, there was Brian Delacroix with several guys like him, looked like they came from money, and a bunch of hot girls. Long story short, I hung around the bar long enough to figure out which coat was his, and I stole it. It was a beautiful coat, black cashmere with blood-red lining. Every time I put it on, I felt...
He searched for the word.
Substantial.
His gaze was that of a little boy lost in a shopping mall.
I couldn't wear the coat much, not in Providence. Too many chances I'd run across him. But once I got bounced from Trinity, I went to New York, and I started wearing that coat everywhere. If I needed to talk myself into a job, I wore it, and the job was mine. Saw a woman I liked, I put it on, and abracadabra, she ended up in my bed. I realized pretty quick that it wasn't the coat, per se. It was what I covered with it.
She narrowed her eyes at him.
The coat, he explained, hid my old man bailing on me and my drunk old lady. Hid the Section 8 unit we lived in that always smelled a little bit of the dude who OD'd in it just before we moved in. Hid all the shitty Christmases and the birthdays we never celebrated. And the WIC checks, and the power getting shut off, and the drunk assholes who hung around my mother, and how I'd probably just become one of those drunk assholes someday in the life of a woman just like my mother. I'd have the same nothing jobs and the same barroom stories and put some kids into the world I'd neglect until they grew up to hate me. But none of that was in my future when I put on that coat. I put that coat on, and I wasn't Brian Alden. I was Brian Delacroix. And being Brian Delacroix on his worst day always trumped being Brian Alden on his best.
The confession seemed to exhaust him and embarrass him in equal measure. After looking at the wainscoting along the wall for a bit, he sighed and glanced over at the papers his sister had signed. He turned one of them upside down on the table.
The trick to forging a signature is to see it as a shape, not a signature. Try to duplicate the shape.
But then it'll be upside down.
Oh, right. I wouldn't have thought of that. We might as well quit then.
She elbowed him.
Shut up.
Oof. He rubbed his rib cage.
I'll teach you how to do it right side up once you master upside down. Fair enough?
Fair enough. She put her pen to the page. In the spare bedroom, she could hear him on the other side of the wall, first as he turned back and forth in the bed, and then as he began to snore. So she knew he was on his back then, which is when he snored, never when he was on his side. It also meant his mouth would be open. Typically, she'd nudge him. Gently, it never took much, and he would turn on his side. She pictured herself doing so now, but that would mean climbing in bed with him, and she didn't trust herself to do that and stay closed. On one hand, this was the definition of insanity. Her life could end tomorrow or even tonight because of this man. No other reason. He'd unleash demons from their basement cages who would not stop until she was dead or in prison. So to feel a sexual pull toward him was batshit. But, looked upon another way, her life could end tomorrow or even tonight, and that knowledge opened up every pore and receptor she had. It transformed and sharpened everything she saw, smelled, felt. She could hear the ping of water moving through the pipes and smell metal in the river and hear rodents scuttle along the foundation. Her flesh felt as if it had been freshly slathered over her body this morning. She bet if she tried to guess the thread count of these sheets, she'd come close, and her blood raced through her veins like a train moving across a desert at night. She closed her eyes and imagined waking as she had once in the first months of their relationship, to find his head buried between her thighs and his tongue and lips moving softly, ever so softly, along her folds, which were already as wet as the bath she'd been taking in her dream. When she'd come that morning, she kicked her left heel into his hip so hard she left a bruise. He grasped the fresh injury, still working the kinks out of his jaw, looking so silly but so sexy at the same time, and she was giggling and still trembling from the orgasm, still, in fact, receiving small electric aftershocks as she apologized. She didn't even wipe herself off his mouth before she kissed him, and once she started kissing him, she couldn't stop until she had to take a gulp of air, a big, ravenous gasp of it. He'd refer to that kiss over the years, say it was the best he'd ever had, that she climbed so far into him with that kiss he could feel her swimming in the darkness of himself. And after she'd brought him to climax, and they lay in the wreckage of the bed with stupid grins and sweaty brows, she wondered aloud if sex was its own mini-life cycle.
"How so?"
he asked. "Well, it starts with a thought or a tingle, but something small, and then it grows." He looked down at himself.
"Or shrinks."
"Well, yeah, after. But for the sake of my argument, it grows and grows and builds in power, and then there's the explosion, and after that, a kind of death or dying, a diminishing of expectation, and usually you close your eyes and lose consciousness." She opened her eyes now in the strange bed and assumed the reason she was contemplating sex with a man she currently hated was because of her proximity to death. And even though her rage at him was as close to the surface as her top layer of skin, she had to tamp down the urge to slide out of this bed, pad barefoot around the corner into his room, and wake him the way he'd woken her that morning. Then she realized it wasn't sex she wanted. Not at all. It wasn't even touch. She walked down the hall and let herself into his room. His breathing changed as she closed the door softly behind her. She knew he'd woken and was trying to adjust his eyes to the darkness as she removed her t-shirt and underwear and left them at the door. She climbed onto the bed, but did so in the opposite direction, her back to the footboard, her feet up by his elbow. "Can you see me?" she said.
"Mostly."
He placed a hand on the top of her foot, but otherwise didn't move. "I need you to see me. That's all I want. Nothing else right now."
"Okay."
She took a minute to compose herself. She didn't have a firm grasp on what she was doing here, only that it was mandatory in some way, essential. "I told you about Witty."
"The girl in Haiti, yeah."
"The one I got killed."
"You didn't..."
"I got her killed. I didn't kill her myself," Rachel said. "But she was right. If I'd let them take her 4, even 2 hours earlier, they wouldn't have been as crazed. They might have let her live."
"What kind of life, though?"
"That's what she said."
"What?"
"Never mind." She took a deep breath, felt the warmth of his hand as he stroked her foot. "Don't do that."
"What?"
"Caress me." He stopped, but he kept his hand there as she'd hoped he might. "I told you that she wanted to go to them, and I talked her out of it, but later they found her."
"Yeah,"
he said. "And where was I during that?" He opened his mouth to speak, but no words came out for a bit.
"You never told me," he said eventually. "I always assumed you two got separated somehow."
"We were never separated. Not until the end, anyway. I was right by her side when they found her."
"So..."
He sat up slightly. She cleared her throat. "The leader of the... pack..." No other word for them. "Was Josué Das Lu. He's actually quite the crime kingpin there these days, or so I've heard, but back then he was just a young thug." She looked across the bed at her husband, as the night rattled the window casings in the old house. "They found us just before sunup. They pulled Witty from me. I fought, but they pushed me to the ground and spit on me. They stomped on my back and punched me in the head several times. And Witty wasn't screaming, she was just crying. The way a girl that age would cry over a dead pet, you know? A hamster, say. I remember thinking, that's what a girl should be crying over at 11. And I tried to stop them again, but man, it just infuriated them. I might have been a white woman with press credentials, and that made raping and killing me a far riskier proposition than raping and killing Haitian girls and Haitian ex-nuns, but they were ready to throw that caution to the wind if I kept it up. I'm looking at Witty as they're pulling her away, and Josué Das Lu slides the barrel of his filthy .45 into my mouth, and he moves it back and forth and in and out over my tongue and my teeth like a cock, and he says, "Would you like to be good? Or would you like to live?" For a moment, she couldn't go on. She just sat there with the tears falling on her body.
"Jesus,"
Brian whispered.
"You know you couldn't have..."
"He made me say it."
"What?"
She nodded. "He pulled the gun from my mouth, and he made me look at her as the men dragged her off, and he made me say the words." She wiped her cheeks and pushed the hair out of her face in the same motion. "I would like to live." She lowered her head, let the hair fall back in her face. "And I said them out loud." When she raised her head a minute or two later, Brian hadn't moved.
"I wanted to tell you that for some reason," she said. "Some reason I haven't figured out yet."
She slid her foot out of his hand and got off the bed. He watched her put her underwear and t-shirt back on. The last thing she heard as she left the room was his voice as he whispered,
"Thank you."
Chapter 33. The Bank. The baby's crying woke her. It was just after sunup. She went down the hall as the cries lessened and found Haya removing Annabelle's diaper on a changing table beside a crib. Brian or Caleb had even thought to hang a mobile above the crib and paint the walls pink. Haya wore a Green Day concert t-shirt Rachel recognized as Caleb's over a pair of plaid men's boxer shorts. Judging by the dishevelment of the bedsheets, Haya had tossed and turned through the night. She dropped the soiled diaper and wipes into a plastic bag at her feet and pulled a fresh diaper from a shelf below the table. Rachel retrieved the bag. "I'll throw it away." Haya gave no indication she'd heard her as she placed the fresh diaper on Annabelle. Annabelle looked at her mother and then over at Rachel and kept looking at her with her warm, dark eyes. Haya said,
"Do women in America keep secrets from their husbands?"
"Some do," Rachel said. "Do women in Japan?"
"I do not know,"
she said with her usual stop-and-start cadence, and then, quite smoothly, "probably because I've never been to Japan." A wholly transformed Haya stared back at Rachel suddenly, a Haya marinated in cunning and curdled wisdom. "You're not Japanese?"
"I'm from fucking San Pedro,"
Haya whispered, eyes on the doorway behind Rachel. Rachel went to the door and closed it.
"Then why are you..."
Haya exhaled so hard her lips flapped.
"Caleb was a mark. I knew he was a con man the day I met him, so I was always stunned he never picked up on my bullshit." "How did you meet? We all suspected like a mail-order bride thing."
She shook her head.
"I was a hooker. He was my John. The woman who ran the escort service would always tell someone who'd never been with me that I'd only been in the country 3 weeks. I was very new at the business, etc."
Haya shrugged. She lifted Annabelle off the changing table and gave the baby her left breast.
"Drove the price up. So Caleb shows up, and right away it doesn't make sense. He was too good-looking to pay for it. Unless he was into violence or severe kink, and he wasn't. Not even close. Straight missionary style. Very tender. Second time he came around, he talked after about how I was the perfect girl for him. Knew my place, knew my role, didn't speak the language."
She smiled ruefully.
"He said, 'Haya, you can't understand me, but I could fall in love with you.'
I looked at his watch, his suit, and I said,
'Love?'
Gave him a real searching, lost child look, pointed between me and him and said,
'I love.'"
She stroked her baby's head and watched her suckle. "He bought it. 2 months later, he paid the owner of the service $100,000 to steal me away. I've been watching and listening as him and Brian put this scam together ever since."
"Why are you telling me?"
"Because I want my end."
"I don't have anything to..."
"Is Caleb dead?"
"No,"
Rachel said, with the emphasis of someone who was almost offended by the absurdity of the question.
"Well, I don't believe you," Haya said. "So here's the thing. If you two run on me, I will drop a dime on you before you can ever get near an airport. And I won't just tell the cops. I'll reach out to Cotter McCann, and they will find you, and they will fist-fuck you in the ass until you die."
Rachel believed her.
"Again, why tell me?"
"Because Brian would take his chances if he knew. He rolls dice. You, though, you're not that suicidal."
"No," Rachel thought. "You should have seen me yesterday."
"I'm telling you because you'll make sure he comes back for me." She indicated the baby. "For us."
Haya was back in character when she asked Brian if Caleb was alive or not, as Brian went over the game plan for what to do if anyone came calling while they were out. Brian lied to her as Rachel had.
"No, he's fine."
Then he asked Haya,
"Which shade do you pull?"
"The orange," she said.
"In..."
She pointed.
"The pantry," Brian said.
"The pantry,"
she repeated.
"And when do you pull it down?"
"When you text."
Brian nodded. He reached his hand across the kitchen table.
"Haya, it's gonna be all right."
Haya stared back at him. She said nothing. Cumberland Savings and Loan was, as advertised, a family-owned business with a history in Providence County, Rhode Island. The strip mall that abutted it had been, until the late 1980s, farmland. Most every bit of land in Johnston, Rhode Island, had once been farmland, and that's who the Thorpe family had originally gone into the banking business to serve, the farmers. Now the strip malls were overtaking the farms, Panera had replaced the produce stands, and the farmers' sons had long since declined a seat on the tractor in favor of a cubicle in an industrial park and a split-level ranch with travertine countertops. The Panera was doing a bang-up business, judging by the number of cars out front. The bank, on the other hand, had fewer cars when she pulled into its lot at 9:30 in the morning. She counted 11 cars in the lot. 2 were close to the front door in designated spots. A black Tesla in the bank president spot, a white Toyota Avalon in the Cumberland S&L Employee of the Month spot. The Tesla gave her pause. When Brian had described Manfred Thorpe, she'd pictured a doughy suburban yokel in a butterscotch sport coat and a cornflower tie, maybe with man boobs and a double chin. But the Tesla didn't fit that image. She scratched her nose to obscure her lips from anyone who could be watching. Manfred drives a Tesla? Brian, lying on the back seat under a painter's tarp, said,
So?
Just trying to picture him.
Dark hair, young guy, works out.
You said he was middle age. She scratched her nose again and spoke into her palm and felt ridiculous.
I said almost middle age. He's like mid-30s. What do you see in the lot? Pretend you're talking on your cell.
Ah, he had mentioned that. She lifted her cell to her ear, spoke into it. The 2 cars by the front door, 4 other cars in the center of the lot, 5 employee cars against the slope at the far end of the lot.
How do you know they're employee cars?
They're all grouped together at the edge of the lot when there are plenty of closer spaces. That usually means the section is for employees.
But Manfred's car is by the doors?
Yep, beside the employee of the months.
7 employee cars? That's too many for a bank this small. You see any heads in any of those cars?
She looked. The knoll backed up to a great red maple that had probably been there when the first Puritans arrived. Its branches were long, its leaves abundant, and the 5 cars sitting underneath it could have been sitting under a bridge for all the sunlight that reached them. If there was a suspicious car among them, she would say it was the center car. The driver had backed into the spot. The other 4 cars were parked nose in. The grill emblem told her it was a Chevy. By the length of it, she'd guess a 4-door, but the interior was impossible to discern under the cover of that shade. Hard to tell, she said to Brian. They're in the shade. She reached for the gear shift. Should I drive over?
No, no. You're already parked. It'll look weird. You sure you can't see into the cars?
Pretty much. And if I stare too long and there is somebody in one of those cars, won't it look suspicious?
Good point.
She let out a long, steady breath. Her blood slithered through her veins. The tom-tom beat of her heart echoed in her ear canals. She felt like screaming.
I guess there's nothing to do but gut it out at this point, he said.
Great, she said into the phone. Great, great, fucking great.
There could also be someone inside the bank. Someone just sitting around, leafing through brochures or something. They could have flashed a fake badge, told the bank they were staking it out because of blah blah blah. That's what I'd do anyway.
Will the person inside be smart enough to spot a wig?
I don't know.
Will they be smart enough to recognize me under a disguise?
I don't know.
Is that all you got? A Hail Mary and I don't knows?
That's what most cons are made up of. Welcome to the club. Dues payable at the end of every month and don't park on the lawn.
Fuck you. She got out of the car.
Wait.
She reached back in for her bag.
What? Love you bunches, he said.
You're an asshole. She slung her bag over her shoulder and shut the door. As she walked toward the bank, she resisted the urge to look across the parking lot where the 5 cars sat under the shade of the maple. By the position of the sun, she guessed she might catch the light right just as she reached the door, but she couldn't conceive of a casual way to turn her head that far left. She caught her reflection in the front door, honey blonde hair that fell to her shoulders and looked completely unnatural to her, though Brian assured her this was only because she wasn't used to it yet. Bright blue alien eyes, dark blue skirt, peach silk blouse, black flats, the uniform of a supervisor at a medium-sized software development company, which is what Nicole Rosevich claimed paid her bills. Her bra matched the color of the blouse. They decided on a push-up bra with just a hint of cleavage, not so much to be obvious, but not so little Manfred Thorpe would refrain from stealing a glance every now and then. If it helped keep him from looking too closely at the rest of her, she would have agreed to waltz in there naked. 10 steps from the front door now, and all she wanted to do was turn and run. The recent history of panic attacks had at least prepared her for a body awash in hysteria. The Saharan tongue, the spastic heart, the electrified blood, every sight too sharp, every sound too loud. But she'd never had to function normally with a panic attack. But now, if she didn't fake calm at an Oscar-caliber level, she would die or be arrested. Wasn't really a door number 3 that she could see. She entered the bank. The history of the bank was documented on a plaque just inside the front door, and in a series of photographs within the bank itself. Most of the photographs were tinted sepia, even though the bank had been established in 1948 as opposed to 1918. There it was as 2 men in ill-fitting suits and 2 short, 2 florid ties cut a ribbon. There it was surrounded by miles of farmland. There it was surrounded by tractors and other farm machinery on what looked to be some kind of holiday. The door to Manfred Thorpe's office was as old as the first photo. Its wood was thick and painted a reddish-brown. The office's glass walls gave way to wooden or faux wooden blinds that were closed. No way to tell if Manfred was even in there. The bank had no customer service station. She had to stand in line behind an elderly woman who sighed a lot until the 2 tellers dispatched both their previous customers at roughly the same time. The male teller, dark, skinny tie over a red plaid shirt, nodded to the elderly woman. The female teller said, "Help you, miss?" She shot Rachel a vague smile as she approached and emitted the air of someone who was rarely present in a conversation, but who'd learned her lines enough to imitate someone who was. She was about 30, in a sleeveless top, the better to show off well-toned arms and a spray-on tan. She had straight brown hair that fell to her shoulders, a rock the size of a Prius on her left ring finger, and she might have been pretty if the skin weren't stretched so tight against her face it gave her the unfortunate look of someone who'd been struck by lightning during an orgasm. She flashed eyes as bright as they were dead and said, "What can we do for you today?" Her name tag identified her as Ashley. Rachel said, "I need access to my safe deposit box." Ashley crinkled her nose at the counter.
"Do you have ID?"
"Yes, yes." Rachel produced the Nicole Rosevich license and dropped it into the tray beneath the glass partition. Ashley pushed it back out with 2 fingers.
"I don't need it. You'll need it for Mr. Thorpe when he's available."
"And when will that be?" Ashley gave her that nothing smile again.
"I'm sorry?"
"When will Mr. Thorpe be available?"
"You're not the first customer of the day, ma'am."
"I never claimed to be. I'm just wondering when Mr. Thorpe will be available." Ashley gave her another smile, this one tight with waning patience. She crinkled her nose again.
"Shortly."
Rachel said, "Is that 10 minutes, 15? How would you define it?"
"Please take a seat in the waiting area, ma'am. I'll let him know you're here."
She dismissed her by looking past Rachel's shoulder and saying,
"Help you, sir?"
Rachel's spot was overtaken by a guy with snow-white hair and a shy, apologetic gaze that he dropped as soon as she stepped away from the counter. She sat in the waiting area with a 20-something woman with a blue-black dye job, a few new-age neck and wrist tattoos, and sapphire eyes. She wore high-end biker boots and high-end wrecked jeans and a black tank top over a white one, both under a white cotton shirt that was perfectly pressed but 2 sizes too big. She leafed through a local real estate magazine. After a few glances, Rachel ascertained that she was quite pretty under the dye job and had the kind of posture one associated with supermodels and finishing school grads. Not the kind of person one would assume worked for Cotter McCann and spent her days staking out a bank. In fact, she barely looked at Rachel, her eyes locked on the pages of the real estate magazine. But it was a suburban real estate magazine, The homes on the cover of the small cape, starter home variety, and this girl didn't give off that vibe at all. She was downtown loft space all the way. Then again, Rachel herself had leafed through plenty of literature that she'd normally never pick up in a variety of waiting rooms over the years. Once, while waiting for her car to be serviced, she'd read an entire article on the best aftermarket chrome accents for your Harley, fascinated by the similarities between that article and one she'd read in a hair salon a few weeks prior on the best ways to accessorize your spring wardrobe. Even so, the way this girl read the real estate magazine, her brow furrowed, her eyes studiously, conspicuously, glued to the pages, made Rachel wonder why she could be sitting there. The accounts manager, Jesse Schwartz Stone, sat in a typical glass-enclosed office, tapping on her desktop keypad with the eraser of a pencil, and both tellers were currently unburdened of customers. The office of Vice President Corey Mazzetti, also glass-enclosed, was empty. "She's waiting for the same guy you are," Rachel told herself. "Maybe she has a safe deposit box as well. Not something you usually see in the possession of a 20-something at a hick bank 20 miles from a medium-sized city, but the box could have been passed down through generations." Who passes a safe deposit box down through generations, Rachel? She glanced at the girl again, only to find her staring directly back at her. She shot Rachel a smile, of confirmation, of triumph, of simple acknowledgement, and went back to her ridiculous magazine. The brown door opened, and Manfred Thorpe stood in the doorway in a light pinstripe shirt, red skinny tie, dark suit pants. As Brian had said, he looked quite fit. He had dark hair and dark eyes she didn't like. They seemed hooded, although that could be because his eye sockets were slightly large for his face. He looked at the two women in his waiting area and said, "Miss..." He looked down at a scrap of paper. "Miss Rosevich?" Rachel stood and smoothed the back of her skirt, thinking, okay, so who the fuck is she waiting for? She took Manfred Thorpe's hand as he ushered her into the office. He shut the door behind her, and she imagined the girl in the waiting room diving into her bag, grabbing her cell phone, and texting Ned or Lars, "She's in the bank." Ned and Lars, if they were watching the parking lot from one of the cars under the great sugar maple, would now search the parking lot. They'd find Brian easily enough. Lying on the back seat of a car under a tarp was hardly foolproof. One of them would open the door, place the muzzle of that silencer to his forehead, and pop, lather the back seat with his brain matter. Then all that would be left to do would be to wait for her to exit the bank. No, no, Rachel. They'd need Brian alive to get the money wired back into their account, so they wouldn't kill Brian. But what did they need her for?
"Now, how can I help you?"
Manfred was looking at her funny, waiting for her to speak. "I need to access my safe deposit box." He opened a drawer.
"Of course. Can I see your driver's license, please?"
She opened her bag, fumbled inside for her wallet. She retrieved it, opened it, pulled out the fake license and handed it across the desk to him. He didn't look at it. He was too busy staring at her. She hadn't been wrong about his eyes. They were, if not cruel, callous and entitled. He'd never formed an opinion about himself and his place in the world that wasn't flattering.
"Have we met?" he said.
"I'm pretty sure," she said. "My husband and I rented this box about 6 months ago." He tapped a few keys, looked at his computer screen.
"It was 5 months ago."
"Like I said," she thought, "about 6 months ago, Dick."
"And you have all access privileges."
Another click on the keyboard.
"So if all's in order, we can take you down there."
He held her license up to the screen, comparing signatures, she assumed, and his eyes narrowed. He sat back in his chair, pushed the chair an inch or two back on its wheels. He flicked his eyes at her, and then back at the screen, and then down at the license in his hand. Her throat closed, followed by her nasal passages. No oxygen coming in, no oxygen going out. The office was unreasonably hot, as if it sat on a thin ledge of shale over the mouth of an active volcano. He dropped her license to the floor. He leaned sideways in his chair and picked it back up, tapped it off his knee. He reached for the phone, and she thought of pulling the gun from her bag, pointing it across the desk at him, and telling him to take her to the fucking safe deposit box right fucking now. She couldn't imagine a world in which that scenario ended well.
"Nicole,"
he said, the phone in his hand. She heard herself say, "Uh-huh."
"Nicole Rosevich."
She realized she'd sucked her lower lip so deeply into her mouth, it probably looked like she